Sanctions has a very specific objective, is to limit the Maduro regime to continue looting the natural resources and the capital of the Venezuelan people, and therefore to increase pressure on the Maduro regime.
Hello and welcome to the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. My name is Megan Rutkai, and I am joined by my co-hosts, Franz Ocilia and Fabiana Corsi. For over 10 years, Venezuela has been engulfed in a political and economic crisis, which has impoverished millions in the oil-rich country and brought authoritarianism to one of Latin America's oldest democracies. Caught in a global geopolitical competition amidst the COVID pandemic, and with upcoming elections in December of this year, the stakes for Venezuela's future are high. To explain how the chaos in Venezuela began and which factors may determine its future, joining us today on the podcast will be Moises Rendon.
Moises Rendon is the director of the Future of Venezuela Initiative and a fellow in the Americas program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, where he provides analysis on a range of public policy issues in Latin America. Prior to joining CSIS, he worked as a legal analyst with Banco Occidental de Descuento, a prominent commercial bank in Venezuela. We hope you enjoy this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. Thank you very much for joining us on the podcast today, Mr. Rendon.
Thank you for the invitation.
Now, Venezuelan expatriates are very well aware of the political and economic chaos that has engulfed Venezuela for over 10 years now. Yet a majority of people in the United States, including our listeners, are not fully aware of the tragedy of Venezuela. So could you give a brief rundown of Venezuela's democratic backslide, first under Chavez and now under the Maduro regime?
Yes, thank you again, friends, for the invitation, and Megan and Fabiana. Venezuela was one of the richest countries in Latin America, right? A country that took advantage of its vast oil reserve to fund a stable democracy that lasted nearly 50 years. But by the late 1980s, this stable democracy was showing signs of weakness. When Hugo Chavez, a little-known military captain, staged an attempted coup in 1992, he captivated the country's port, and they had grown disillusioned with the status quo. In 1998, campaigning on populism and redistribution, Chavez won the presidential election. And this is really when everything started, because he started implementing a set of policies that changed the country forever, right? Over his nearly 15 years in office, Chavez systematically set out to weaken democratic institutions, increasing his own control over the national legislature, the courts, the military. He removed his own term limits. And when he died in 2013, Venezuelan democracy was on life support. His successor, as you mentioned, Nicolas Maduro, continued the same pattern. In 2017, after his party lost control over the National Assembly, Maduro created a Constituent National Assembly, named the new legitimate legislative body, and staffed it entirely with party loyals. These efforts culminated in 2018 snap presidential election. Opposition leaders were barred from running. The state used its power to systematically intimidate voters, and Maduro won in an election widely recognized as neither free nor fair. And this is kind of the basis of why the international community recognized Juan Guaido as the legitimate president starting in 2019. I can maybe refer a little bit of the economic collapse, right? Because Venezuela hasn't suffered only a political humanitarian crisis, but it's also an economic collapse that is entirely man-made, by the way. That there hasn't been any earthquake or any natural disaster that created this crisis. This crisis has been created entirely because of man-made policies. So Chavez oversaw an unprecedented oil bonanza, managing nearly $1 trillion in oil revenue during his tenure. Under the guise of 21st century socialism, he distributed billions while gradually eroding the country's democratic institution. Chavez also tripled the country's external debt and nationalized the oil, telecommunications, and power industries. And when he died in 2013 again, he left behind an indebted autocratic state that was more dependent on oil than ever before. And as the oil price the price of oil began to plummet. In 2013 and 14, Venezuela spiraled into an economic collapse. So again, the policies of Chavez and his successor, Maduro, have done little to improve things on the ground, and quite the opposite. The older policy has put Venezuela in a very vulnerable position when it comes to economics and international trade and private sector investment and everything that we know that helps countries to grow.
And Mr. Rendon, the success of Hugo Chavez and Nicolas Maduro, and more broadly, the success of Chavismo as a whole, has come partly due to the Venezuelan opposition's inability to work together in the past. Why have opposition leaders in Venezuela over the last 20 or so years found it so difficult to unite?
Yeah, I mean, this is a very important, timely question, right? And it's kind of the $1 million question that we all are asking. There is really not one answer. I think the Venezuelan opposition, on one hand, has been working in a very repressive, very difficult environment where their families and their colleagues and their themselves has been targeted violently, and their physical and mental health has been threatened systematically, right, by a very autocratic, authoritarian government. So it's a very hard environment to operate in. That's on one hand. On the other hand, the opposition in Venezuela has historically been divided. They have not reached any a stage where all of their political parties and leaders have been on the same page. Quite the opposite. In the last 20 years, we have seen many opposition leaders and political parties fighting with each other and not focusing their fight against a very common cause, right? And in part, I mean, I will say, this is only my opinion, obviously, but I will say it's part of a history of the country, the culture, but also the political system in Venezuela. In Venezuela, you have over 28, it's a multi-party system, right? It's not a bi-party system, almost like we have in the U.S., where, you know, you have Republicans and Democrats, and the rest of the parties are not as relevant. In Venezuela, no, you have multiple parties. And just to give you an idea, there are over 28 political parties within the opposition only. Then you have the official government party, the PSUV, and you have about two or three more who are part of that coalition, the government coalition, including the Communist Party. So you can see, as you manage 28 different interests and visions and different opinions, it's hard to concise into a unity, into a one kind of unity position. So again, there has been a lot of issues, and today obviously the picture is completely different than 20 or 15 or 10 years ago. Today, corruption in Venezuela is kind of a spider web. It's affecting everybody, including the opposition members. Corruption has been, infiltrated in the National Assembly, outside the National Assembly, and in a way, it's changing the political dynamics, right, in Venezuela. And so it's the problem is much more deeper and complex than what we had when Chavez was around.
So on the topic of the growing opposition, from the victory in the 2015 National Assembly elections to the massive protests throughout 2019 and to the recognition of Juan Guaido as Venezuela's legitimate leader by the international community, it seemed like the Venezuelan opposition had positive momentum going their way. Has the opposition been able to turn this momentum into positive action in 2020?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, no, right? Because today we still have the status quo as we had it before Guaido came in. I mean, while the opposition has been exposing new challenges and new opportunities, there hasn't been a much of a positive action that we all were hoping for when Guaido was recognized in early 2019. Obviously, Maduro remains in power, and there has been little sign that his lifelines, including the military and his international allies, are abandoning him, right? Like, they're still very much supporting Maduro. The status quo only benefits Maduro, so the longer this crisis continues, the better his position is going to look. Secondly, the opposition movement is experiencing increased challenges, both internally and externally. Internally, the opposition consists of a coalition of, as I said, very different parties. They have been fairly unified since Guaido took office, but the coalition is starting to show signs of fracture. There is significant ongoing division between Guaido, who opposes participating in the upcoming parliamentary elections in December 6th, and former presidential candidate Enrique Capriles Radonsky, who supports now participating in such elections. A divided opposition only helps Maduro. Externally, the Supreme Court replaced the leadership of the three opposition parties, Primera Justicia, Voluntad Popular, and Acción Democrática. And you know, as long as we have these Supreme Court replacing all the opposition leaders and banning them to participate in such elections, it's going to be hard to see a free and fair election among other conditions that they need to take place, right? So yeah, unfortunately, the international community is frustrated. Many of us are frustrated because the opposition hasn't accomplished what it should have been. No, last year when 60 countries recognized Guaido to support him, there were lost opportunities throughout last year. And I think, in a way, we need to learn the lessons and come up to the drawing board with a newer, fresher plan and look into 2021.
So from that international perspective, let's take it a little bit closer to the ground level. How does the public of Venezuela itself view opposition efforts like those led by Guaido, you know, from the inside of the country, your everyday citizen?
Yeah, that's a good question. So good data can be hard to find, right? But there has been some concerning numbers. A recent poll by Caracas-based firm Data Analysis says that support for Guaido dropped in polls from more than 60% in February 2019 to 25% in May of this year, according to, again, Data Analysis. The pollster put Maduro's May approval rating at about 13%. And I think that number still remained the same since he hosted this fraudulent election in 2018. It's always around 10 to 13%. I think the recent fractures from within the opposition indicated that people are losing patience with the current strategy. It's been over 18 months, right, since Guaido was sworn in, and Maduro is still in power. So there are natural, logical reasons why we see his numbers dropping down now.
And, you know, what role has the military of Venezuela played in keeping the status quo in the hands of Maduro?
Yeah, I mean, the military has been a key actor to keep Maduro in power. Unfortunately, the Venezuelan military is in a way a completely politicized, has been also infiltrated by external actors, including the Cuban intelligence, right? And that's where the Cubans play a key role in Venezuela. They make sure that the Venezuelan military are not, or any faction of the military are not organizing any coup or any unrest against Maduro's regime. And they have been very effective to neutralize any factions that come to the surface on that note. So it's been one of the lifelines for Maduro to stay in power, to keep the military in track. And in a way, he has done that not only through surveillance and kind of increase fear among the military members, but also giving them business opportunities, right? And that's where the problem gets more complex, because Venezuela right now is a country that has been that is being looted by different actors, but including the military themselves, and they are in charge of the oil sector, for example. They are in charge of the border controls, customs. They control many of the territories that has gold and other minerals. So in a way, they cooperate with other criminal organizations that are currently extracting illegal gold mining and other resources. So it's a business opportunity for many of them to stay, to have the Maduro regime stay in power. So that's why the problem is so complex. In a way, Venezuela has become a mafia state, and the military are just big part of that structure.
I'm glad that you mentioned the suppression of the opposition in this context. Could you speak to how Maduro has used the COVID-19 pandemic and the military to silence his opposition in the last few months?
Sure, yes. I think Maduro has used COVID to expand his control. The regime is using the military and colectivos, which are militias, to enforce lockdowns and close down streets. The opposition cannot assemble in mass and protest like they did in 2019. So it's a problem for the opposition too. There's also food and medicine shortages throughout the country, not to mention gasoline shortages that are affecting the day-to-day life of Venezuelans. I also understand COVID-19 has been used as a control mechanism in poor communities, where, again, they are enforcing curfews, and every time a citizen or someone goes out on the street, they send them to jail, and especially if they're not affiliated to the government party. So again, COVID-19 has been both a social control tool, a demobilization tool on the opposition side, and has been an excuse overall for Maduro to keep the Venezuelan people in their home and not having them on the street protesting of all the problems that they face day to day.
Wow, the political situation certainly looks grave. And returning to your earlier comments about Venezuela's economic collapse, which has only worsened since Maduro came to power, could you please describe the consequences of this economic downfall in terms of the humanitarian suffering and national shortages, both before the pandemic and now even during the pandemic?
Yes. So again, this goes back to the policies that we were discussing earlier that Chavez and now Nicolás Maduro promotes, right? Like this, since 2017, Maduro's solution has been to just print more money. Right, and this has led to a period of what is called hyperinflation, which is when a country's currency maintains an inflation rate of over 50% for at least 30 consecutive days. Inflation in Venezuela reached 10,000,000% in 2019, and the COVID-19 pandemic has worsened the situation. There has been an increase in the use of dollars in Venezuela. This is known as dollarization in a way. But dollarization primarily benefits the elite and well-connected people. Venezuela currently owes more than $200 billion to foreign creditors, leaving it in a precarious situation with a collapsing oil market and, honestly, the constraints of U.S. sanctions as well. So, I mean, overall, the economic picture of Venezuela is grim. Venezuela does not have the resources, despite the vast oil reserve, to manage this economic collapse by itself. It needs the support of the international community. It needs the support of international private investment. But before we get there, and we have to be honest, that they're really not a economic solution until you get a peaceful democratic transition, right? And even that wouldn't be enough. You're going to have to rebuild trust. You're going to have to rebuild institutions before you get into, you know, basic monetary policies and fiscal policies. So yeah, the picture doesn't look good from the economic point of view.
So it seems that Maduro's policies to, you know, try to fix the crisis have been ineffectual, but even, you know, even with potentially the right policies, without a, you know, democratic political resolution, any economic policy might not be enough. So how does this grave economic situation impact the Maduro regime's political power?
Yeah, so that's a great point, right? Like, we tend to think that because Maduro's the collapsing of the economy is affecting Maduro's grip on power. But the last 2 years have proven quite the opposite, that the more that the economy continues to collapse, the more the Maduro regime moved towards illicit activities, right? Like narco trafficking, illegal mining, money laundering, corruption. And I think the Maduro regime's lifeline now relies on these illicit activities, and that's how he is able to pay and sustain the government, right? And that's one of the collateral damages or collateral effects of sanctions too. The more Maduro is isolated from the world when it comes to economic revenues, the more he moved forward to other illicit activities that are not, dismantled by sanctions or not targeted by sanctions themselves. So that's why we also have seen, on the positive side, we have seen indictments, for example, and other decisions by courts, especially in the U.S., but also in other parts of the world, where they are now indicting officials for criminal activities, right? And we're not talking only about economic, but also criminal activities. So that's where we're moving now. We're seeing the Maduro regime moving towards that illicit activity zone, and that's why it's becoming more of a mafia state than anything else.
Now, Mr. Rendon, switching gears a little bit towards the international sector, Venezuela has also become an important geopolitical stalemate between Russia and China on one side and the United States on the other. Could you elaborate for our listeners what each country's goals are for Venezuela and what tools are they using to either assist or pressure the Maduro regime?
Sure, yes. The two of the countries you mentioned are probably the most important, Russia and China. But also we have to point out others like Cuba, as we discussed, Iran, Turkey are probably the other ones that follow. But let's stick to Russia for now. Russia has a more geopolitical, some economic approach to Venezuela, right? The involvement in Venezuela, it tracks back in when Chavez was in power. Chavez made sure to develop a great relationship with Putin and Russian leaders. And you know, at this point, the fact that Russia sits in the UN Security Council and supports Maduro politically and diplomatically is a big support for Maduro, no? And in so many ways. Russia has about $17 billion in investment, especially in the oil sector, through Rosneft, one of the most important Russian state-owned oil companies. However, just recently, especially given to sanctions, and again, there are positive and negative effects. This is one of the positive. One of the reasons Rosneft decided to leave Venezuela was because of the sanctions constraints, right? And Rosneft provided an economic, financial lifeline to Maduro. That said, still Russian's government still they're still in Venezuela. They want to make sure that their assets and their investments are protected, and they still support politically and diplomatic Maduro. But again, Russia has more a geopolitical approach to it. It's just as some policy colleagues say that it's just a cheap way to poke in the eye of the U.S. And that's why they want to remain in Venezuela for the time being. China, on the other hand, has more of a business approach to it. China, as you know, has a huge demand in oil and natural resources. They have 1.3 billion people to feed. So they need Venezuelan oil and Venezuelan resources. And that's why they have provided over $55 billion between 2007 and 2016 in loans and investments, right? The problem for China is that they know that their investment in Venezuela is precarious, is not as legitimate. One of the reasons is because the National Assembly, since 2015, since the opposition took over, they haven't signed on any of these agreements. So they are afraid that their investments will not be protected in a transition scenario, right? And that's one of the obstacles that we see of why China hasn't changed their position on Maduro, because they don't see an opposition wanting to protect their assets and their investments in the future. So that's one of the problems that we have right now with China. And again, it's also important to know that China's involvement in Venezuela is representative of their larger geopolitical strategy, the Belt and Road Initiative. China has increasingly invested in regions like Latin America as a way of expanding their global influence while securing much needed resources for their economy. So to beleaguer regimes that no longer trust or work with Western-backed institutions like the World Bank or the IMF, China provides an alternative source of capital, right? Without many of the conditions and stipulations about human rights that these other organizations have.
And now I want to switch a little bit. I want to dive a little deeper into the United States' role in Venezuela, because years of U.S. sanctions do not seem to have moved the needle in Venezuela, or at least not yet. So I want to get your opinion on how could these U.S. sanctions be improved to be more effective?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question again, because sanction has been a pillar of the U.S. policy towards Venezuela, right? Let me just say right off the bat, I mean, lifting sanctions right now would be counterproductive, I think. But the sanctions can definitely be improved. For example, by providing more accessible exemptions for humanitarian aid organizations. You know, and this is something that not many people know, but oftentimes U.S. banks block their transactions and their organizations lack the resources and capacity to troubleshoot these issues around sanctions. So the Treasury Department can definitely do much more to ensure that U.S. banks, but other banks and other organizations on the ground have the capacity to maneuver all these delicate architectures of sanctions regimes to see how they can transact, right? Because the least thing that we want to do in Venezuela is to suffocate the private sector and punish all Venezuelan citizens that are trying to transact and trying to do their day-to-day operations on the ground. Sanctions has a very specific objective, is to limit the Maduro regime to continue looting the natural resources and the capital of the Venezuelan people, and therefore to increase pressure on the Maduro regime. We don't want to increase pressure on the Venezuelan people, nor the private sector, or in much less in humanitarian organizations that are continue to operate on the ground. So again, the Treasury can do much more. There are multiple ways to improve that. I just mentioned one just to be brief, but you know, the Treasury can increase its capacity to respond to any issues that are coming from the Venezuelan citizens or organizations. They can create a commission, for example, to oversee how sanctions have been affecting the humanitarian space and many others, right? Like there are multiple ways to help, and I think we need to get there. And it's important that the last thing I'm going to say on sanctions is that, you know, it's important to understand that sanctions are not a silver bullet, right? On their own, they are not going to bring about a democratic transition. So another way to think about this is, how can the U.S. strategy as a whole be improved? One key component is to better understand how and why other countries are helping Maduro evade sanctions, and asking ourselves what carrots and sticks we can use to get these countries to stop doing that.
In May of this year, you and Alexandra Winkler outlined four possible scenarios for Venezuela's future in 2020. Could you briefly run through each of these scenarios for our listeners?
Yeah, sure. Scenario one is a status quo. This will be synonymous of continued collapse. The economic and humanitarian situation continues to worsen as the Maduro regime becomes more repressive, and Maduro increasingly relies on the military and his international allies to prop him up, and continues to violently suppress the opposition movement, right? Which is pretty much what we have today. Scenario two is, you know, what we describe: dialogue, give Maduro more time in power. But given the current context, we can also include the parliamentary election will give more time Maduro to stay in power. So in this scenario, Maduro takes advantage of the U.S. democratic transition framework and COVID-19 and the fact that some opposition members are running for the elections in December 6th to initiate another round of negotiations with the oppositions and, you know, try to let time go as all these new negotiations start. Similar to what we saw last year, these negotiations will then break down as Maduro will never agree to, I don't think, to have free and fair elections in the country. But again, but this move buys him time while the country continues to spiral into a deeper crisis. It's a very delicate, complex scenario because, again, I understand some international allies want a democratic, peaceful transition in Venezuela, and that means pretty much elections. But unfortunately, the conditions are not there to have free and fair elections by this December. It's a dilemma that will only benefit Maduro and his cronies. The scenario three is what we call the alternative regime change. This scenario is essentially a palace coup, where high-level regime officials turn on Maduro and replace him with another Chavista leader or the military themselves. And this will be spurred by some combination of curtailing the illegal markets through which Maduro buys loyalty, Maduro becoming more toxic, and the promise of lifting targeted sanctions appeals to certain high-level officials. This scenario has lots of unknowns who replace Maduro, but could lead to a near complete dissolution of the country, leaving various non-state actors and foreign powers like Russia and Cuba, like we discussed, to struggle, right, for power and the country's natural resources. So it's a very, very complex scenario because there's a lot of unknowns on what will happen after. The last scenario we had was a transition government starts. This is probably the most promising of those who want to build a prosperous democracy in Venezuela. Here, both Guaido and Maduro will step aside for a temporary council of state to administer free and fair elections with international oversight. Both will be eligible to run, by the way, which is ironic for many. But for this to happen, both internal and external power will have to increase, with the EU and the Lima group supporting the democratic transition framework and working to isolate Maduro while some military and regime officials defect. And, you know, if you ask me which has been the most accurate for 2020, I will say some combination of a scenario one and a scenario two.
Okay. Well, as you mentioned, Mr. Rendon, Venezuela is set to conduct National Assembly elections this December. As you mentioned, there is very little chance that the elections would be free or fair, and the opposition has announced that it would not be participating in these elections. What's behind this decision not to participate, especially given the results of a similar tactic in the 2018 election?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And it's, again, the question that will remain on the table now until December, right? And it's why Venezuelans cannot just go and express their vote and their opinion. And it's hard. It's hard for many international community to understand because, again, it's a complex crisis. Look, there are simply no conditions to have free and fair elections by December of this year for several reasons. One, just from a humanitarian perspective, between fuel shortages, COVID-19, and fuel insecurities, potential voters face even greater challenges, right? They either don't have time to go and vote because they're looking for food, and the COVID-19 in Venezuela is dangerously getting much worse given the collapse of the health system. And honestly, the Maduro regime controls the distribution of most food resources. So, and we know that they're using those food resources to, repress voters to vote in favor of the government. So from a purely humanitarian perspective, I see it very hard for Venezuelans to go out and vote. From a security perspective, it's also hard because, as you know, pro-government armed groups or colectivos will almost certainly be used to intimidate potential voters at the polls. And we have seen this approach in the last elections in Venezuela. So the voters will put their lives and their well-being at risk by just going out to the voting stations on the election day. The last reason I think that has weight on why we are just not in a position to have free and fair election is purely from an infrastructure and technical perspective, right? There was a fire in March of this year that destroyed 49,000 voting machines, and previous elections have demonstrated extensive system irregularities and equipment malfunctions. So today's electoral infrastructure in Venezuela is just not there to host these type of elections. According to the OAS, which is the prime electoral expert institution in the region, they say that they need at least 6 to 9 months to get the infrastructure and the technical capacity in Venezuela to have elections. And obviously they haven't even started today. So December is just coming up around the corner, and they're just not technical conditions to have elections either. So, and on top of that, on top of those three reasons, as you know, the Maduro regime has taken several steps to ensure its own victory by banning opposition leaders, to run for elections, by increasing the seats of the National Assembly. That way will benefit the Maduro regime's strategy towards the regions that he controls the best, and other tactics that we've seen. So it's hard, if not impossible, to have free and fair elections anytime soon in Venezuela.
That sounds incredibly bleak, but thank you for that information, Mr. Rendon. You know, so far on this podcast, we've discussed many of the complex trends that have contributed to Venezuela's current bleak economic and political reality. To close us out, for our listeners, in your opinion, what does the future of the Venezuelan interim government and Venezuela as a whole look like?
That's a great question. Look, it's going to depend in many factors, right? Like, on one hand, you have a very important presidential election in the U.S. that will impact the way the Venezuelan opposition operate moving forward and how they are recognized by the international community. I think either way, though, whoever wins on November 3rd, it will still support the interim government of Venezuela led by Juan Guaido, and they will still support their efforts to, you know, limit the suffering of Venezuelans, but also move towards a democratic transition. That said, depending on who wins, it will change the focus and will change the shape of how the opposition engages the international community. Secondly, as we have discussed, December 6th are a big event coming up, and that will shape the future of the opposition in many ways. If we remain in the status quo, which is not unity and a divided opposition, then the future looks much more bleak, right? That said, I think the interim government has the edge here to continue working together with the U.S. and most of the countries that recognize Guaido, and continue, you know, selling the idea that they are the only, which is true, the only legitimate constitutional institution that is left in Venezuela out of the National Assembly, right? The only way, the only reason they exist because the current National Assembly is the only remaining institution left. So after December 6th, that would be a good question for what is going to happen with the current National Assembly, and if there is a new National Assembly, what's going to be replaced. You know, based on Venezuelan law and what we've seen in policy throughout the last year or so, I think the most likely scenario is that the current interim government and the current National Assembly will remain the recognized institutions by the international community. And until free and fair elections, again, free and fair elections can be held, then until then, the National Assembly, the current National Assembly, the Guaido coalition will remain recognized and will remain the head or the lead of the Venezuelan opposition. So yeah, I'm happy to circle back whenever December 6th happens and see where we are at that point. But those are the key questions that we need to keep in mind for the future of the opposition.
Well, we would be more than happy to have you back after December 6th as well. But Mr. Rendon, thank you very much for joining us today on the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for the invitation. It was great to be with you guys.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. We hope you enjoyed it. We would like to say thank you to the International Studies Program and the SNF Agora Institute at the Johns Hopkins University for making this episode possible. Remember to follow us on social media at Hopkins POFA, that's at Hopkins POFA, on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook for the latest of our content. Hit follow on Spotify, subscribe on iTunes, and feel free to leave us a rating and a review. We'll see you next time.